Welcome to Ira's Everything Bagel, where I talk with intriguing people about everything, their passions, pursuits, and points of view. Please like, share, and subscribe. It really helps the channel, and I appreciate it. I'm not Jewish. That's how my guest today answered questions about his identity for most of his life. Dr. David Weil is the son of a Jewish father who escaped Nazi Germany and a Southern Baptist mother, and while raised in New Orleans, religion wasn't part of the conversation. Instead, medicine became his calling. As a leading organ transplant specialist, his work defined him until a crisis forced him to confront the questions he had long avoided. Who am I? Where do I belong? Well, that search led to his powerful new book, Tell Me I Belong, A Journey Across Faith and Generations, published by Union Square and Company. And it's to the conversation we're having today. To learn more about David, you can visit David Weil and spell W-E-I-L-L, davidweil.com. Follow him on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. And David, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. How much lesser was a crisis writing the book than the crisis you faced? And we'll talk about what the crisis was. How was it when you were writing the book itself?
Interesting. It was quite a journey. It moved around in time and space, and also geographically. I really literally went all over the world with this book, and got to meet a lot of interesting people, and it was profound. It was a very moving experience all around.
I bet it was. What was for you the crisis that caused you to all of a sudden ask yourself, well, what am I, who am I, where am I, and all of those whys? And
I had a pretty classic midlife crisis where I was beginning to have some professional disillusionment with my job as a transplant specialist. I ran the transplant program at Stanford for many years and became disillusioned with modern medicine and the hospital politics, and watching patients die became very difficult to me. And this was all in the face of having lost my father also, who died during that period, somebody who I was very close to and was my North Star, if you will. And so when all of that happened, right around the time I was 50 years old, I began to really investigate more about my true identity.
And what was the spark that set it ablaze in this sense? When you started to question your identity, was there one thing you came across, either a letter, a book, a diary, a conversation with your father, et cetera? Was there one thing that set you on that journey, besides obviously questioning who am I?
Yeah, there really was. So throughout my whole life, my parents didn't raise my sisters and I with any religion. I, as you mentioned in the outset, I'm a product of a Holocaust survivor and a Southern Baptist mother from Selma, Alabama. And we didn't have any religion growing up. We couldn't answer the question, what religion are you? And so I eventually, after many, many years, took on Catholicism as my religion, went through a formal process to become Catholic, was fairly happy with Catholicism and being Catholic and being able to answer that question. And then my mother, just a few years ago, and this is what actually started my whole journey with the book, she told me, oh, by the way, I converted to Judaism before I married your father. And so by Jewish law, therefore, I was Jewish. And
correct.
So even though I was happily identifying as Catholic at that time, I began to really question it and wonder, am I in fact really Jewish?
Can we back up for a second, though? You said that you were raised, obviously, in an environment where religion wasn't an issue, or not an issue, but wasn't part of your life growing up. So what drew you to Catholicism or to any religion at that point before you then hear about Judaism?
Well, I think my spirituality really happened, really sparked in the hospital, and seeing the things that I saw, talking to patients who relied on religion to get through a very difficult time, a transplant operation.
Absolutely.
Really sparked that in me. And then Hurricane Katrina hit my hometown of New Orleans. I wasn't living here at the time, but it got me interested in what I thought was a biblical event, more or less. And I started reading the Bible front to cover, and I did it 3 years in a row. And the problem is I didn't have any context for what I was reading. And it also didn't sit well with me that my wife at the time, devout Catholic, and my kids were raised Catholic, and all of that was going on. And they would go off to church every Sunday. I would go off to the hospital, my own place of worship. And it just didn't sit well. So I decided to become Catholic at that time.
And then the change happens. You flip it. You're in the world of religion. Let's put it that way. And all of a sudden, well, you have a choice of A through Z of religions. There is Buddhism, etc. But what was now the spark that flipped you from Catholicism to Judaism? And was it a significant moment when that clicked in your mind?
I think it was when I found out that my mother had converted to Judaism before she married my father. She didn't really have a great explanation for why she did it, but she just said that's what people did. And she's 90 and wasn't able to really explain much beyond that. But at the same time, it got me thinking, well, if my mother converted, I'm in fact Jewish. And that's when I started looking into my family history, and we come from 600 plus years of German Jews, mainly rabbis, going back to the 1300s. So I began to discover that heritage, which was important to me.
It connected you in a way with not just religion, but with history, I would think.
That's right. I mean, obviously a lot happened during that period. And, you know, had it not been for World War II, which is kind of like saying, had it not been for the iceberg, the Titanic would have made it. Yeah. I'd be a German boy and raised that way. But World War II happened and the Nazis came to power and my family was either killed or dispersed around the world.
When you started down that path, and of course, without getting into the weeds, because I can read your book, which is the important thing in terms of the overall, the questions that you faced, the answers that you came up with. Again, it's called I Belong, A Journey Across Faiths and Generations. When you decided to embrace Judaism, generally speaking, again, without going into the weeds, there's a choice of Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox, and other versions and branches as well. Did you stay away from picking a particular branch until you immersed more in the, you are a voracious reader. So did you read the Torah back every year like you did the Bible? Or how did you decide where you were going to end up in this spectrum?
Well, I consider myself in the first inning of that process. So okay. I'm literally taking an online course right now called Judaism 101. And I don't know a great deal about Judaism. And I'm going to start with finding out some of the fundamentals of it and then go from there. But that's part of being me. I kind of have to go through a process to get to an answer.
Sure. Part of your title of the book is Tell Me I Belong. Do you feel, after completing the book, do you feel right now you belong? Even though you're taking an online course in Judaism 101, do you, or 101 technically, but okay, we won't quibble. But at any rate, do you feel you belong?
I do. I think the connection finally came when I looked at this long family history in Germany. In fact, the last section of the book, I visit Germany and hang out in the villages that my family was from. And my last name is all over billboards and street signs and cemetery plots. There was a lot of us there. And I think at that point, I really connected with the family and I connected with Judaism in that way. And I think it took me doing this whole project in order to do that.
As part of that overall journey, are you also looking to go to Israel and explore that part of it as well?
Yeah. I went to Israel once in 2011, but it was more, I can't really say it was a religious quest. It was more of a political quest back then. I went actually with a political organization and went with my closest friend when I was living out in California, who's Catholic. And we both went really because of our interest in the politics of the region rather than the religion. But I'm certainly going back now, that's for sure.
When you finished the journey and you wrote the book and you looked at what you've researched and people you've talked to, are you firmly committed now to your current religion? I'll put it that way, of Judaism. I mean, are you there for the duration? That might be the way to phrase it.
Yeah, I think I really am. I think this process really was about finding my way back home. And I think it was there all along, but I had to go through my own path to get there. You know, I have thought about it my whole life. I've thought about religion my whole life, actually. And I think I just needed to find that way home. And I think I finally have. So I don't think there's going to be any deviation from here.
The interesting part that I thought was when you mentioned earlier that your father was your North Star, that there was a reluctance on his part, I'm assuming this, to discuss Judaism with you, even though your mother converted in order to get married and have you as a child, and therefore you are automatically Jewish, is the way it usually works. But why was there a reason? Was it because of the Holocaust that he just didn't want to talk about any of that?
Yeah, my father didn't talk about what happened in Germany at all, and neither did his father, who was in a concentration camp. And not only that, my father was not a believer in religion at all. In fact, he was a man of science, and he's one of these science-oriented people that doesn't see the evidence for religion and therefore is not a believer. In fact, he often quoted the Karl Marx saying that religion is the opioid of the masses. And he took some degree of pride in that. He was not only not an adherent to Judaism, but to really all religion.
Well, I guess I'm confused then. Why did your mother feel she needed to convert if he could care less?
It's an excellent question. And one that I posed to her in a variety of ways. And she really couldn't come up with a firm answer. You know, she really mostly said, that's what people do. That's what I did.
So it was a time and period situation where at that point, at that time, that was considered the thing to do if you were going to have.
I think so. They got married in 1958. And, you know, I guess that was something that people did back then. But she certainly didn't do it with the intention of raising her children.
Right.
Jewish.
Right. No, I understand that. When you were at Stanford and you said you had issues there with the politics, et cetera, did you also find some sense of comfort with the chaplains and rabbis that would have been at Stanford in terms of a hospital setting?
Definitely. Some of my closest allies, if you will, the people that I was closest with in the hospital were hospital chaplains. And I think that those folks gave me a lot of help as I was watching people that I cared a lot about die, and people barely make it, and people come back from the afterlife, and all kind of different experiences that I write about in the book. And they really helped me. And even more than that, to hear patients talk fairly regularly and invoke their own faith in trying to get through these tough times, I often thought, if it worked for them, maybe it would work for me too.
Despite your father being an atheist and obviously never spent time in a foxhole.
That's exactly right.
There are no atheists in foxholes.
Right.
When you think about your career, though, and you mentioned earlier in our conversation about leaving because of the politics, but wouldn't your skill and your talent override those concerns and those objections because you're saving lives in many cases? Yes, you don't always save a life, but you certainly save X number of lives. Isn't that almost more important than your own personal feelings about politics or issues?
Yeah, it did for a long time. You know, the abilities that I was given to impact people's lives really sustained me for a long, long time. The problem became, and this is common now in our hospitals, sadly, is that the interest of the clinicians, the people taking care of patients, is not the same as the interest of the people running the hospitals. And I think that that misalignment of interest is what's going on in our hospital systems today. I work as a consultant in the healthcare space, and I see it all the time. And that's disturbing.
It is, but wouldn't it still be stepping up to the plate and continuing to use your skill and talent despite the obnoxiousness of the political aspect of it?
I think people can do that for a certain amount of time. I think there's an expiration date on that.
Yeah, you know, that's fair. That's good to know. When you started, I'll use this term journey because it seems to be the popular jargon these days. When you started your journey and exploration of what was your new life and you went to Germany, as we mentioned earlier, was it a shock to you in terms of things that you found? I don't mean in a bad way, shock. I mean in a almost a opening your eyes shock of what you discovered when you started researching and going to Germany and seeing all the your name all over the place and your family members, et cetera.
Yeah, it connected me to the country a lot more. And it also made me realize that I can read about this until I'm blue in the face, but actually breathing the air in these little villages, these are tiny places where my family was from, really helped me understand what the feel of the place was, if that makes sense. But even more than that, especially when I visited the concentration camp that my grandfather was in, Buchenwald, I think when I was there, I realized, and I remember walking around the stone quarry that he had to work in, I realized how much sacrifice the people before me had made so that I could write a book and do a fair amount of navel gazing in terms of my own exploration. There was a lot of people that didn't have that opportunity and a lot of people that set the groundwork for me to be able to do it. And I think that's what I felt most profoundly when I was there.
Because you're one or two generations removed, I assume when you went to Germany, you didn't have that sense of uncomfortableness that Jews of a certain generation had after World War II about visiting Germany. There was always that trepidation. And that was passed on, I think, to the next generation. But you're about the third or fourth generation at this point. Did you feel any of that?
No, I really didn't. I did remember my father telling me that the first time he and his father went back was in 1962. And they had planned a week-long visit to their home country after many years away. And they ended up leaving after a day and a half. I don't feel that when I go there. You know, it's a different time, a different era. I don't believe in collective guilt and all that kind of thing.
And yet the artifacts remain of that period. So it'd be easy to shift into that mode.
I think so. And to the credit of the German people, you know, they've maintained these places and they've, you know, had various memorials that are still in place. And I don't think there's any attempt to whitewash any of it. At least I didn't see any attempt to do that.
You went to Berlin with your daughter, Hannah. So now there's another generation. What was her take on your experiences? And I'm sure she knew you were researching and going to write a book.
Yeah. I think, again, you know, technically, I'm a second generation Holocaust survivor. And so she would be a third generation, technically. And so the further you get removed from it, the more it does become something in a textbook, a black and white photo of what happened there. But I think she can understand just watching me go through that process and watching, and she knew my father, and trying to understand that she had some connection to all of that. It's more remote, but I mean, she still has a connection to it. And I thought it was kind of neat because I got very interested in this concept you may have heard of and your listeners may have heard of called emotional inheritance or inherited trauma is another way to talk about it.
Right.
And it seems to really pass from generation to generation, especially in Holocaust survivors. But I have a feeling that it's going to stop with her generation. I don't think she's going to feel that. I think she's too far removed.
What was her take on your decision to convert to Judaism and to follow this path?
My whole family was supportive, actually. I think they very much know about the struggle I've had with religion generally and just want me to find a home and pay less attention to which home I find as long as I find one. So the whole family has been very supportive.
And there's a lot of commonality among religions as well, exactly, with some exceptions, of course, but even so. And I think, too, in the area you deal in the medical world, there I'm sure is a divide among doctors, too. You have the doctors who are very skilled, who are atheists or agnostics, and you have doctors who are have a faith, whatever that faith is, and yet they still perform their medical duties. but they see things, I think, in a different way. And would, if you were practicing today, would you see things in a different way? In other words, when you saw recovery as a miracle, but then also death in some cases, which is not a miracle, but it happens, you'd be able to square the circle in a way as a man of faith versus as an atheist performing medical duties.
Yeah, I think I would be a different doctor today. And one thing that would be, I think, even bigger, more important, is when patients used to talk to me about faith, and they did a lot. They talked to me about God and it's in God's hands and whatever happens and things like that. I arrogantly thought it's not in God's hands, it's in mine. I won't think that anymore. And in fact, I was uncomfortable a lot of the times when patients were trying to talk to me about their own spirituality because I didn't have that. I think now, if I were in the hospital, patients talking about religion and God would not make me uncomfortable. I think I'm just better versed in it.
And I think a way to synthesize that is that it's not in God's hands or in your hands. It's God using your hands.
I think that that's right. I think so. But, you know, as a young physician, we think the good outcomes are due to us. And unfortunately, we also think the bad outcomes are due to us. It's a double-edged sword, trust me.
I'm just staying with the hospital for one more second. In the world that you worked in, the transplant, for the doctors that didn't have any faith and they would see death, would there be an emotional reaction in general to the death of a patient from a doctor who doesn't believe in any faith at all? Or do they just sort of say that's part of the price, the cost of doing business in a way?
I think I saw a lot more of the latter, you know, next patient, who's next, move on. And doctors also are notorious for not exposing their own emotions to each other. So how these folks were processing all of this at home, I don't know. But I saw more of, you know, this, it's a risky business we're in, this happens, and they kind of move on. I saw that pretty commonly.
Yeah, I would think that in a way that takes away from one's humanity, even if they deal with it at home and process it at home. But when you're in the hospital setting, when you have a family gathered around someone who has passed away because the transplant didn't work, you would think it would open up more people, but evidently it doesn't. But I guess all humans are different in all kinds of different ways and how they react to things.
I think that's right. I mean, when I was younger, I would also try to move on quickly from patient to patient. And then as I got sort of later in my career, I actually started to have more trouble emotionally watching a patient die. And in fact, what's interesting or probably not surprising is the families actually, when they saw me tear up when we lost a patient, I think it connected me to the families much more than just, okay, well, I'm sorry, thank you, and then move on. I think toward the end of my run in the hospital, I felt as connected to the family members as I ever have.
What do you want people to take from reading your book? Are there two or three main points about what you want to communicate? Because it's your personal journey. Again, I use that word journey. It's your personal story. And yet you're writing it for a wider public. So clearly there's a message that you want to communicate. And it may be one message, it may be three. And if you have three, that's fine. We have about 4 or 5 minutes left. So why don't you tell us what you want people to get out of the book of reading the book?
I think the main thing, and this is one misconception I had when I started doing this work, is that I was one of a very few people that had struggled with their own religious identity. I literally thought that it was a very uncommon thing and that most people could easily identify with one religion or the other. That's not true. As I did this work, I met more and more people that had similar struggles and they would tell me about them. And now, as I've gone out to promote the book, people are telling me that they've also struggled with a similar thing. So as a writer, all of us, you know, and in my previous two books, the same thing. I want readers to see themselves in my journey. And I think that's probably the most important thing. But probably a subtopic of that would be, and I think you touched on this earlier, about the universality of all these religions. we are a very tribal people, and we want to join one team or the other. But at the end of the day, these religions are a lot more similar than they are different. And I wish we would stress that rather than the differences that we see people stressing all the time. My journey was more about finding out who was my team, but it certainly was not a repudiation of anybody else's team. It would never be that.
No, it's a positive story in that sense. You're not rejecting anything, you're accepting something.
That's exactly right.
When you think about it, if you were still at Stanford and still working in the transplant area, would you have been able to write this book?
No. I don't know that I could have written any of the three books that I've written.
What are the other two books? You might as well mention them while I have you.
Yeah, so in 2021, I published a book called Exhale, which was about the emotional roller coaster of doing my kind of work. And because I couldn't quite go far enough because it was nonfiction and there were certain sensitivities around it, I wrote a novel about the world that I lived in. About a very arrogant transplant surgeon who wasn't me. So that was good. Writing books, it's a great endeavor. I love it. But it's all encompassing. And anybody that writes a book will tell you that. So I don't think I could be, you know, an 80 to 90 hour a week transplant doctor and write books on the side.
Your first book was Exhale, and the second book was?
All That Really Matters.
All That Really Matters. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, before I let you go, when you finished writing the book, was there a sense of, to use the title of your first book, was there a sense of exhaling?
Definitely. This one took the most out of me by far. The other ones kind of spilled on the page. This one took a lot of inner searching, and I frankly was glad to be done. I really was. And now I'm in the phase, the book's been out less than a month, but I'm in the phase now where I'm going around talking about it, and I'm glad to be talking about it rather than still writing it.
Although once you're done with the promotion side, then you can exhale again.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. That'll work.
That usually takes about as long as the writing part of it does.
That's a great way to leave it. My guest has been Dr. David Weil. He's the author of Tell Me I Belong, A Journey Across Faiths and Generations. It's published by Union Square & Company. The book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org, and all the usual places. And for everything about David, go to David Weil. That's W-E-I-L-L, davidweil.com, and follow him on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. And David, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, and join us every Thursday for a new schmear on Ira's Everything Bagel.